Hello and welcome to the Working Parent podcast. This podcast season is designed to support working parents throughout lockdown and beyond. My name is Sharon Charlton Thompson and I'm one of the co-founders at the Working Parent Company. You can find out more about us on Instagram or on LinkedIn and via our website, theworkingparentcompany.co.uk. In today's episode, I speak to Jen Rolfe, who's a positive psychologist and has worked alongside us at the Working Parent Company for quite a few years. I speak to Jen about how does a positive psychologist parent? What's the most challenging things about her in being and becoming a parent? And what has helped her the most? What does she know from research in positive psychology and the study of positive psychology and well-being that have been the most useful for her as a working parent? I hope you enjoy. So Jen, welcome to the podcast. It's really lovely to have you here and generous of you to give us your time, as I know this is a critical week in your calendar because you have Festival of the Girl launching this weekend. On that note, can you just tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. And thank you for having me. It's always a real honour to be invited onto this kind of thing. So all listeners out there, I hope I've got something useful to say. So my name's Jen. I'm a positive psychologist, which means that I study or have studied in the past when I did my qualification, well-being, resilience, emotions, all that kind of thing, happiness. And over the last 10 years since I did that, I've been working in that field in leadership management and soft skills training and coaching. And as Sharon just mentioned, alongside that, I've had two children, two girls. And during that process, I set up a couple of social enterprises to that end. One called Not Just a Princess, which is all about smashing gender stereotypes in kids and their clothing particularly. And one is the Festival of the Girl, which is happening this weekend and is doing the same kind of thing, but in a different way. So celebrating girls and trying to remove any limitations placed on them by their gender. Psychology runs through all of that, to be honest. So although they're three separate businesses, there's quite a lot of overlap in what I spend my time doing. Yeah. That's a bit about me.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And this podcast will probably now be launched after Festival of the Girl. So if anybody who's listening Googles it, you'll see that it's already happened in early October. But it will of course happen again next year, and maybe that will be a live event next year. So definitely something to follow.
Yeah, hopefully. And there may well be some of the content that you can get hold of depending on when you are listening to this. So it's worth a look.
Oh, great. Okay, that's definitely worth mentioning. Okay, so Jen, I'm really excited to speak to you today because one of the things that interests me is how do practitioners in this field be parents themselves? And so how does a positive psychologist parent, and what is there to learn from you about being a working parent and having all the tools and skills at your disposal? One of the first things I wanted to ask was, can you remember what was the most challenging for you about becoming a parent?
Wow. I've got a lot of things, if I'm honest with you, that have been really challenging. For me, it's been different with number one and number two. And I talking to other parents, I think that other parents find this sometimes too. I think with my first daughter, the biggest challenge for me was my sense of identity shifting. Yeah. And in the field that I am, I was quite aware of that, and I wasn't really prepared for it either. I have run my own business for 10 years, so I was 6 years in when I had my first maternity leave, and the business is very, very tied to me and what I do, and that's who I am, that's where I get my self-worth from. So to suddenly not be working and be with this baby that I had no idea what on earth I was doing. Yeah. You know, from coming from a field where I'd felt quite confident and happy in, to dealing with a baby that I was utterly confused by, not to mention the sleep deprivation and all that kind of thing that comes with it. My identity was really shaken by it, I think. And it took me quite a long time with my eldest to get I wouldn't say good at it because I'm not sure I am, but to get confident with it. And when I say it, I mean being in charge, you know, not looking around for the other grown-up who's yeah. meant to, you know, and suddenly yeah. realize that, oh, actually, that's me. I mean, I felt very lucky that my husband had lots of godchildren when we had our first daughter, and most of his friends had had kids at that point. So he was very confident. And I do remember feeling like I'd let him deal with it where I could. And I went back to work very quickly. I went back after 4 months and doing my first piece of work. And I remember thinking, oh, okay, I'm getting some energy from this. I know what I'm doing. Right, I can replenish that energy and use it then in the parenting when I'm back. So I needed work to help me parent.
I think that's such a great thing to say out loud, that actually work can be a resource. Mm. And it can, you know, it can give us energy that we take back into our parenting.
Yeah. I mean, I feel very lucky that I do a job that I really love.
Yeah.
So it therefore gives me energy. And I know that not everyone's in that position, but for me, it was incredibly important to do that because I needed something to, I remember feeling like I was clinging on to something that I could still do because this baby was so uncontrollable and alien to me. And building confidence as a parent, I think, is really hard.
Yeah, because, absolutely.
You know, and the second children, you know, you think you know it, and then they come along and they're different. So you yeah. have to learn all over again, but at least you have a slightly better starting point.
Yeah, absolutely. What happened to that sense of identity? You said it was really shaken.
I think that I needed to rebuild it. Mm. I think that I had thought that I could take on being a mum as well as who I was in my working field easily, and it didn't slot in as easily. I felt like they were very separate initially. I felt like I was really terrible as a parent. I can't tell you how many times I, you know, said I'm rubbish at this. I still say that occasionally as well, by the way. It feels kind of ironic talking about myself, giving, you know, any tips, you know, because I think yeah. every parent out there doubts themselves. But I think that I didn't integrate it into a sense of who I am straight away. It took me quite a long time to do. And I'm still learning, I think. Mm. I feel more confident now having two of them and having done it for a bit longer. But it's as they start, the fields of my life start to mesh, if that's the right yeah. word, it's becoming easier. But I think I just was really thrown by it because my identity was often built on being quite a confident person. That was probably the crux of it. And I just wasn't with my first baby. I just didn't know what to do.
As a positive psychologist, do you think that, you know, when you look back at now at that sort of meshing, as it were, as, you know, my pre-mother version yeah. of myself and then my mother version of myself, you know, it's just something I'm curious about is whether that meshing is a process, an event, does it need conscious energy? Is it something that just crept up and then one day you thought, okay, yeah, I know who I am again now?
Do you know, I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I think that I was definitely unprepared for that element of parenting. You know, you do the classes and you learn how to do a nappy and you think about, oh, I can feed and I'll be deal on less sleep. I was, again, slightly ironically, given my field, I hadn't really thought about that sense of identity being shaken. And so it was something that I had to reflect upon. I know I do remember a moment when I went back to work thinking, you know, like I mentioned, that sort of sense of relief almost that I could still do something. Yeah. Oh, there's still something I could succeed at, you know, because I felt yeah. like I wasn't. So there were definite moments of that. And in hindsight, I think had I known that before I became a parent, I might have thought about it in advance and it might have been an easier process. But I don't know. I imagine it's different for everyone. Mm. You know, and it maybe depends on how you feel about your work and how you feel about parenting, because I wasn't one of those people that it wasn't a key dream of mine to have a child. Mm. I'm delighted I do, don't get me wrong, and I love them to bits, they're wonderful, but it wasn't my life goal, and so maybe that's to do with the way it worked for me as well, because I was very driven and happy with my career, that it took a while to balance.
It's really interesting, this territory, because as a coach working day in, day out with working parents, I think there is something here about accepting that the situation has changed. It's not everybody, but for some of us, you know, we have our babies, we return to work, and we imagine we can be exactly who we were, mm-hmm. in the same way, you know, show up in the same way, run our day in the same way, mm-hmm. be spontaneous in the same way. And a lot of the challenges are about when that is taken away from us, because the situation has changed.
Yeah.
And we do need to make adjustments. And it's in those adjustments that often the struggle comes.
Yeah.
When I listen to you talk about that meshing of identity, I have my own story to share, which has just popped into my head, which was when my now eldest was very little, my neighbour used to take care of her when I first started going back to work in the beginning. And I was at a large pharmaceutical company about to do a presentation, and I got a call on my phone to say that my neighbour had had to take my daughter into hospital because she had shoved sweet corn up her nose. And she had tried everything. She tried the pepper, she tried the feathers, you know, to get the sweet corn out, and it wouldn't come out, and it was getting to the end of the day. And I had to drop everything and rush to the hospital, obviously, to be with my little girl and, you know, sort of be there and see to her. And I remember getting in the car and driving to the hospital. And that was one of those moments, like everything has changed. Because I'm not in control anymore. You know, there's something about having to acknowledge I'm not in control anymore, and I've got to be there when that stuff happens. And that was one of my it sounds so silly, but it was one of my big sort of, oh my goodness, my life is now much bigger than other things that I need to take care of.
As often happens, it's reminded me of a story that is the very first. So when I went to my daughter's very first day at nursery, so my eldest, she was 6 months and 3 days, and I had a full day workshop in London, and I live in Oxfordshire, and so I wasn't there to drop her off. And I do remember guilt is like ever prevalent, but I do remember feeling awful about that. And actually, so it wasn't so much the having to drop it, it was the presence in the room of the work. Yeah. And it was, I could feel it, and it was difficult for me to switch into being there in the room.
Yeah.
And actually, I had a conversation with one of my participants. I was at a retail company, and actually, as it happened to be a group of women. And I'd mentioned it was my daughter's first day at nursery, and they'd known me for a little while. And she said, the way I dealt with this, Jen, is that because I felt bad when I first went back to work about, she said, I see my kids' upbringing as not down to just me and my partner. It's us, it's our grandparents, and it's the people that work at the nursery and their teachers. We're all part of the village. We're all part of the family that bring them up. And I really remember that, just almost like a sense of release when she said that, that helped me be more in the room, because my mind was not all there. Because you're thinking about what could be going on, you know. For me, it was not dropping her off, you know. For you, obviously, you had to go and be there. But if they're slightly ill, or you get that text or a missed call from the nursery or something, your mind goes. So how do you, you know? And it's trust almost that the village is there, that the people are all there. They're in the best possible hand if they are in childcare.
And how important that village is.
Yeah.
You know, I think as working parents, our number one priority is having a good support network.
Yeah.
And without that, you're so vulnerable, you know, to all of this stuff, and so vulnerable in your own capacity to bring all of yourself to your work or all of yourself to your mother-in or father-in or whatever. And it's those tensions, isn't it, that are difficult, you know, when you're there, but you're not there.
Yeah.
You know, those are the difficult moments, I think.
They really are. And arguably the other way around, I think, at the moment, particularly with everyone working from home, and I've always worked from home, but am now virtual in terms of the training I'm delivering, the other way around. So being all there as a parent, I think, is much harder now, because I've always got ticker tape of, oh, I should be doing this, or I haven't quite finished this, I'm going to do this in the evening. And the boundaries between that, I think, are really, really tricky.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even as somebody who's fairly practiced at working from home, having done it for more than 10 years now. But I think it's getting increasingly more challenging for people.
Yeah.
And that's something I've noticed.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly with some clients, you know, if you're in one room trying to work on Zoom or whatever platform you're working on, and the baby's in another room with the nanny or a partner, you hear them cry.
Yeah.
You know, we all know as mothers what that emotional pull is like when you hear your little one cry or distressed or something.
Yeah.
So hard. You know, I find that, you know, remaining in presence and returning to presence is something really important to practice, and knowing, like you say, that village is there.
Mm,
the nanny's got it, or the partner's got it, or, you know, whatever. And
whatever it may be,
can we tolerate that and ride those waves? Yeah.
It's hard. And I think you have to, so there is some research on this that I also found quite comforting, and I talk about in workshops on this, around how present you have to be and how often.
Yeah.
Because, you know, children can be all encompassing.
Yeah.
And it's a lady called Julie Morgenstern who talks about this idea of 5 to 15 minutes regularly, really, really present with your kid. And the most important kids, and the most important time is when they're when they've just returned from something, or when they've just got up. So when they're just back from school, or when they've just got up, you know, meal times, whatever it is, you know. So one thing I've tried to do, and I'm not always successful at it, is make sure I don't have my phone. And I'm sitting and really talking to her about her day, or, you know, we're really trying to bond over whatever thing we might be doing, if it's a jigsaw or whatever it is. And then it's easier to then move away from that, and you can do things at the same time with them in the same space, but you've had that time where you are really focused, just 5 to 15 minutes. And I forget it regularly, and I always find it really helpful to remind myself, because then you can, and I've tried it for me, it does work. If you really focus that time with my eldest, obviously my youngest is a baby, so she's not that bothered, but with my eldest, is 4 and a half, she wants to play with us all the time.
Yeah,
please play with me, please play with me.
Yeah.
So going, okay, I will, and I'll throw myself into this properly, and I'll have a really high value time, it ends up being a shorter time overall than if I try to do two things at once.
So true. And I think that, I mean, my kids are young teenagers now, and that still applies.
Mm.
You know, so that, I love that high value time.
Mm.
You know, I know, we all know what it feels like to truly be present, you know, to solo task versus multitask. And I didn't know about that research. That's really interesting to see that there are moments like waking up, coming in from school, key moments when that is more impactful in a way. Mm-hmm. But not only does it serve the kids well, I think it serves us well as well.
Totally. Well, I'm not going to talk too much about her research because I'm not the expert on it. She is, but she talks about this idea of time management for parents, which I love. And I will just refer to one thing, because again, I found it very freeing when I heard about it, was that we, as parents, we spend time providing, arranging, teaching, and relating. So we have these four different tasks, or all of our tasks can be split into those four. And when you think about it, most of the time we spend providing and arranging, because that's working, or, you know, loading the dishwasher, planning the meal, cooking, washing their clothes. But then you say, what does your kid notice? Well, it's relating and teaching. And it was, I think it's a really interesting take on the way we time manage for parents, because we never have enough time. So for me, it is about value, getting value out of that time, and realizing that they don't care that much about the providing and arranging, even though it has to be done. So how do you get the high value moments of relating and teaching? And that's really her philosophy. So it's when I use it, it helps, and it's worth exploring her. She's got a book on it. I think it's called Time to Parent.
Time to Parent. That's so helpful. And I, just as I'm hearing you saying that, I'm thinking when I'm under stress, I think my default is providing and arranging.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
You know, I go to that busy place of providing and arranging, and I forget to slow down and to go into relating.
Yeah. Well, as your brain goes there, doesn't it? So you're always thinking of the next thing, or, you know, I've got to make tea, or I've got to, you know, it's, and I'm the same when I'm under pressure. I go into control mode, you know, how many loads of washing can I get done? And, you know, this needs doing, and my brain isn't present because it's thinking of the next challenge. It's thinking of the next thing that needs to be done. And it drives my husband crazy, but it doesn't help my relationship with my kids.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, yes, they get fed on time and get to bed on time, and that is important, but I think that mental load is stressful.
Yeah.
And so being aware of it on the days when I've had enough sleep and energy to be aware of it, I can practice switching back into relating and teaching.
Absolutely. This is helpful because we're sort of talking about what helps you the most as a parent, you know, the lovely freeing little reframe that person gave you of, you know, it takes a village.
Yeah.
And now the, you know, the sort of quality, high value time.
Yeah.
And that, what else, what other top tips do you have?
That helps me. Well, I think it's really important. I never really hinted this, but I think it's really important to say I'm not able to use these tips all the time.
Of course.
There's no such thing as perfection with parenting at all. With living, I don't think there is. Other things that have helped me. So looking after myself, because that, I know it's a cliche, but you can't pour from an empty cup. You just can't. And having time, in fact, in lockdown it's quite my story. So my youngest daughter was born 5 weeks before lockdown, so we basically spent a lot of her early life not going anywhere. And when drive-through coffee places opened, my Sunday ritual became feed her, hand both children over, and go to the industrial estate in the town near where I live, get a coffee and sit in the car on my own. And it was lovely. I never ever feel that I have time to do that, but I have learnt to make sure I do it. And whether it's time on my own, whether it's exercise, not that I do enough of that, but you know, nobody probably feels that they do. I know that I need that to replenish my energy, and I can't be a good parent or partner or, you know, facilitator if I don't do that. So looking after myself is definitely the biggest thing that's helped me. And the other thing I think is an idea of playing to my strengths.
Yeah.
It's taken me a while. You know, I've been a parent for 4.5 years. There'll be people listening who've been a parent an awful lot longer. Sharon, you've been a parent a lot longer. But getting to know what actually really works for me, what I enjoy doing with my daughter, and not trying to do everything because it takes a village, and because my husband can do a lot of stuff that she likes to do.
Yeah, too. Absolutely.
You know, we sing and dance together. We do crafts. That's the thing that we really love. Jigsaws, building. We really love Lego. They're the things she wants to do with mummy. The going outside, the DIY, sounds very gender stereotyped, ironically, given my other businesses. She does different things with her dad. She cooks quite a lot with her dad. And it's knowing what I enjoy doing, because then it's not using up my energy when I'm, again, the high value time. It's energizing both of us.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
yeah.
Getting to know what my strengths are and being okay with that, because I can't do everything.
Yeah. How do you spot strengths, Jen? I mean, for people listening, we talk about our strengths and we imagine that we know what they are. But of course, generally speaking, we're all much more tuned into our weaknesses.
Yes, we are.
And our strengths. So how do you spot strengths and know what you're good at? Or is
Yeah, well, there's lots of ways you can do it. I think the very simplest is to look at your energy levels. So if you, a question I often ask people to think about, it depends whether you're talking in work or at home or a bit of both. But when you think about something that you've done recently that you find that you were really proud of, that you really enjoyed, that whizzed by, the time whizzed by, you gained energy from that experience, that's usually you're using a strength. And a strength is different to a skill, because I can do DIY, I can do really detailed things, I can do lots of cooking, but I don't love it. It's not the thing that really brings a buzz. So differentiating between a strength and a skill, I think, is the one of the hardest things about this. And so I would look at, you know, try to be aware of what things give you energy. What's your, if you were to design the perfect day, what would you end up doing? What would give you the most buzz? What would you be most excited by? And chances are what the things you're doing in there are your strengths. If you stick it into a search engine, there's all sorts of tools out there that you can look at that are more work focused too. But the simplest way is really to look at, if you were to design your perfect day, other than, you know, sleep and travel and eating and that kind of thing, what would you be doing and why? You know, what is it about that would really give you a buzz? And that's probably your strength.
So I've got a brilliant example, because this weekend just gone, when very stormy weather, I was actually in Cornwall.
Awful, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was actually in Cornwall with some girlfriends, and we weren't thinking about strengths necessarily, but we were thinking about, you know, COVID and the big sort of reset that's gone on for so many people.
Yeah.
We're thinking about 2021 and dreaming of a day when this is all over, perhaps, and what would our ideal day look like? And I was really struck by how simple the days were, you know, whereas if I go back 10 years ago, my ideal day would have been dressed in white linen on a Caribbean beach or something. Well, my ideal day, that what came out of my mouth in the moment in this little cottage in Cornwall, was getting up, having a really lovely coffee on my own somewhere, getting the balance right between solo time and time with friends, because I'm assuming my day is a school day, so my kids are at school. And because sometimes, you know, I can get to that being an extrovert, I can be very energized by company, but if I do too much of it, I become very depleted by company as well. But my afternoon was coming home, having time to sit down and read a chapter of a book without being distracted. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
And then batch cooking. And when you say what is a strength and why, I love cooking with my kids, but I love batch cooking and filling the freezer, because I know then that everybody's going to have good nutrition, which is something that matters to me, you know, going forward. So we don't sort of slip into brown food nights. You know, they happen, obviously, fingers feature large, but you know, that there is something that's quick and easy that we can just grab from the freezer.
So there's a strength in planning there. There's a strength in creating. There's all sorts in there from that story. And I wonder, did you have the discussion of how different that would have been last year?
We didn't.
Curious, isn't it? Because I do think there's the taking pleasure in the simple things is part of, what a great phrase that was, Sharon, the reset.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, what's happening is that, going back to the heady days of March, when we all thought this would all be over by Easter, you know, now it just feels crazy. Then we anticipated by September we'd be back to normal, and we're still in this very sort of liminal space, you know, of betwixt and between normal and not normal. And we haven't gone back to how things are. And I think people have fundamentally been having reset conversations because it's gone on for so long. If we had all gone back to normal in Easter, we probably all would have walked back into exactly how things were. But now I'm cautiously optimistic about what the future can bring for working parents.
I think so. I feel incredibly lucky that my daughter was not at school age during lockdown, and I was on maternity leave. I mean, the thought of having to do all of it with no childcare at all, the boundaries have just been all over the place. So anyone listening to that, high five to you. That's all I can say. More than high five. But they, yeah, I do think it's quite interesting. The a number of conversations I've been having since I've been back at work have been around people feeling like they should be okay, but not feeling okay, but feeling like it maybe isn't okay to not be okay.
Right. Yeah.
Because people have it worse, or because they haven't suffered directly, or, you know, they have a nice garden and they feel like they should appreciate it. And it's, I think that, you know, that's the other thing. And it links to parenting and happiness in general, is that happiness and well-being is not about sticking a happy face on it and everything's fine.
Mm.
And comparing to people who have it worse or better doesn't help.
Well, the inner critic, the inner critic loves comparing.
Yeah, doesn't
you know, we compare and despair, and it's really interesting that you're hearing that, because the inner critic will come in. You know, if I'm moaning about not feeling great, or, you know, just feeling what's going on, you know, I'm not feeling great, the inner critic will come in and say, well, you can't moan because so and so down the road, well, they haven't seen their mother who's in a nursing home for 6 months, or. Mm. You know, do you know how many people are in the local hospital? Or, you know, so the critic loves that. It loves to help us compare and despair, and creates a lot of suffering for us. Whereas actually the whole experiences through this last 7 months have been incredibly personal.
Mm.
Everybody's had a different route through. Everybody's had different things to meet, different challenges to meet, and it doesn't serve us to compare.
It doesn't. And I think just realizing that this level of uncertainty at a global level does cause psychological distress. It does for everyone. Yeah. Even if you're mainly fine, even if you're a positive psychologist.
Yes, absolutely. It's
we are, as humans, we get threatened by change. We can't really stop that reaction, and so, you know, noticing it is where you're going to learn from it, and trying to do things to manage it and replenish your energy and get, unfortunately, I think we all have to get used to the idea of uncertainty, because
it's here to stay. What's the most useful, Jen, useful or practical thing you've used for your own well-being?
There's a few things. I think I'm very, very aware of the physical exercise I need for my own well-being. So in terms of practical, currently, in fact, this is very current, because I am doing an October challenge to myself that I set, where I need to do at least 15 minutes of physical exercise a day. And I have a little sticker chart for myself, because my daughter's got one, so why don't I have one?
Yeah.
And I've done that because I realized the hormones that when you've got a baby rage through your body do mean that there's certain activities you can't do. And I had a back injury and I just kind of got out of the habit. So in terms of a practical habit, it's breaking it right down to something I can do that's only 15 minutes.
Mm.
And it, for me, I'm increasingly aware that I don't exercise for anything other than my mental health and energy. And I never want to do it. Well, occasionally I do, but very rarely. But that is one of the things that's really, really helped me. And in terms of my well-being and with the kids, the other thing is a gratitude practice, which, again, I got out of doing. But I now do with my I started this beginning of lockdown, actually, with my daughter, is at the end of the day at bedtime, it's now part of her bedtime, is what were your best bits of the day? And she makes us answer it first. She likes to force us into answering it first. But it means that we do look back on the day and go, what were my standout lovely moments? And because if I'm doing it with her, I will always pick something to do with her.
Yeah.
Usually. Not always. I usually make sure 2 out of 3 are to do with her. Then I also look back on a nicer day than I do thinking, oh my gosh, it's another day of stress. getting through it.
Yeah.
The gratitude practice and physical exercise for me are probably the two most practical things that are most timely at the moment.
Yeah, lovely. And what about positive psychology research, or research generally? What does it say about happiness and well-being and parenting?
Well, it's a big question, because it's a little bit inconclusive, and it's not the most happy it's not the most happy news either in terms of what it says. So the general consensus is there's too much context that goes on around becoming a parent that means that you can't really generalize. So you can't really understand it without considering the timing and the context with which somebody becomes a parent. That said, the research does show a dip in well-being in comparison to non-parents of a similar age and stage and all that kind of thing. But it's a dip in what we call subjective well-being. So joy, positive emotion, and absence of negative emotion. And that does seem to be, in most studies, generally a bit lower with parents compared to non-parents. That said, there's another side of well-being called psychological well-being, which is broadly described as optimal psychological functioning. Right. And so the research is kind of, that includes things like purpose and self-acceptance, positive relationships is in there. So that doesn't seem to be as knocked. And in fact, there is some research that suggests that gets a boost. So it's a muddy picture, essentially, yeah, in terms of certainly what I'm aware of. And I wouldn't consider myself a total expert in this field, but from what I have read, that seems to be what's going on. And I think the other thing, from my personal experience, that's what the research said. I would say that's about right. I mean, I feel such a sense of purpose and protection and fierce love and positive relationships with my kids and what I want for their future. And the highs are higher, but I think the lows are lower as well, you know, because of the lack of sleep, especially when they're young, and the mental load of juggling it all. So that's what I know of.
Yeah.
I don't know how that resonates with your experience.
It resonates completely 100% with my experience. I think that dip in well-being, I've seen studies that show that as well. And in a way, it feels like the inevitability, really, of an increased care burden. You know, that inevitably that's going to have an impact on well-being. And you're absolutely right, context is everything with these figures and these stats. But that at the same time, that's almost balanced out balanced out by a sense of much greater purpose and legacy, I think. Mm. You know, I get a real sense of a legacy value when I think of my kids and what one day I'll be leaving behind in the world. You know, my hopes and dreams for them, that is something that really energizes me as a mother. Mm. In my parenting. Yeah, it's interesting stuff. And what have you learned, would you say, about yourself and about your field of work in your time since you've been a parent?
I think, a lot, but I think the shorter answer is that I think I used to think that I could think my way out of a lot of things. Mm. There's techniques, you can challenge your beliefs, all that kind of thing. And I'm aware, very in pregnancy as well, and parenting, the impact of, it's not all cognitive. It's the relationship between your energy levels, your hormones, your how that impacts your emotions, and the almost the whole self well-being. I think I'd been very focused on the mental, cognitive side of well-being, and had maybe not appreciated the impact of all the other sides of it. You know, when you're physically exhausted, or you've got hormones running through you, or you've not slept properly, and that sometimes your mood is a little bit out of your control, particularly for women. And so I think that's the biggest thing I've learned, and not to think that I can think my way out of it all the time. And sometimes you just have to have a glass of wine and a bar of chocolate.
Yeah, lovely.
Or something like that, or a bath, or go for a run, you know.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think we are so focused on the cognitive, aren't we, in the West? And our thinking will only ever get us so far. That is the truth of it, in my experience. Our best thinking will only ever get us so far. Mm. And that there's something much wider, much broader that we need to encompass when we think of our whole self. We think of this remarkable life that we're all given. And how do we care for this remarkable life? You know, not just in service of ourselves, but in service of our families and our colleagues and our, you know, our lives generally. Then it's a much wider lens to hold up to the world. And in fact, our cognition, our thinking mind, can of course become the very thing that sabotages us, because you know, when we're, you know, it becomes our shoulds, what we should be doing. You know, we all know what we should be doing, and that can become a sort of internal slave driver, you know, in and of itself, that isn't very helpful and does deplete energy. So there's something about, our wonderful brains and minds are helpful to a point, but they're not the full picture. And learning to tune in to something wider and broader than that, I think, is really, really important.
Yeah. And it's definitely struck me, particularly over the last few years, the importance of balancing all of that. And I think for me, it was becoming apparent that triggered it and experiencing it directly. But I think I will keep learning that as I get older.
And
hopefully I will get much older.
Cheers to that.
Yeah.
So to close, can I just ask you something that we're asking all guests, which is, if you could have one sort of super hope, super dream for a post-COVID world, something that we're learning through this time, or something that would inspire you or you'd want to take forward, what would it be?
I have thought about this, and there'd be quite a few things, but I think, given everything I've just said, I think it would be to slow down a bit. You know, we all did it and we went, well, that was nice. And then as the world is opening up again, we can quite easily go back into that fast-paced, constantly providing and arranging, if I use those phrases. But to slow down and enjoy it a bit more and be present and spend the time doing that as a daily practice, whether that's parenting, whether that's working on something you love, whether it's just eating a really nice meal or having sitting and appreciating your coffee. So often we just glug things down and we don't, because we're running out the door. I'm a horribly late person, so that often happens to me. So I think if the world could slow down a little bit, I think that would be nice. I don't know what the impact would be on the economy, because I don't understand that, but I think I would wish that the world could slow down a little bit and enjoy itself a bit more and focus on the now.
I think that would be really nice too. So we'll end there. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, that was really good fun. I hope it's been nice to listen to, whoever's out there.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. I'm definitely taking away the wish of a slightly slower pace of life, where space really does pay. And also the concept of high value time with our children, that really spoke to me as well. I look forward for you listening in for future episodes, but above all else, at these extraordinary times, please stay well, stay connected, and stay resourced. Thank you.